Chappaquiddick is in theaters April 6th.
Good morning. Welcome to Radioactivity. I'm Rob Lori. Coming up, we're going to talk with the mayor of New Orleans about that speech that he made a year ago condemning racism and advocating for the tearing down of Confederate statues in his city. We'll talk about what's happened since then, too, with Mitch Landrieu, the mayor of New Orleans, in just a moment. Later on, we'll open up the phone lines and take your phone calls and talk about some of the big issues of the day. First, two listener comments about yesterday's program. Yesterday, we got an update about the trial of Noor Salmin, who is the wife of the Pulse nightclub shooter. That trial is going on in Orlando. We got an update from Ahmed Badir of our True Talk program. And then late, we also heard from Bart Ehrman, who's a religious historian and a scholar at the University of North Carolina, on his new book about the spread of Christianity in the first 300 years of its existence. After the show, we got these two phone calls.
Hey, Rob, this is Bill over at the Wildlife Rehab. There's another story here that nobody seems to even whisper about. I suspect that the people killed at Pulse, I don't believe Mateen was responsible for most of those deaths. You know, many probably, but they mentioned one time that they'd be, you know, looking into who was killed with what, and you know, any so-called friendly fire, but nothing. Haven't heard a word since. How about that? Has anybody been looking into that? I haven't heard anything. That's about it. And good luck to Mateen's wife. I think that's kind of a travesty, what's going on, too.
Listening to the show, listening to the professor on religion. It basically, listening to his show, the key thing that I zeroed in on is he's not a believer. He acknowledged the existence of Christ, which most religious and secular atheists acknowledge. But they don't believe that Christ died on the cross for their sins. And that's the key thing to zero in on. Now, there were so many vague innuendos and assumptions that he made and conclusions. Understand this. It'd be nice to hear a believer on this show that wrote a book, which I've never heard before. I've never heard it before.
Two listener comments that came in after yesterday's program. We'll give you a chance to talk to our audience in just a few minutes when we open up the phone lines. But first, back in May of last year, New Orleans Mayor Mitch Landrieu addressed the people of his city about his decision to take down four Confederate monuments in the city. His speech, which has been heard by millions, sparked a national conversation about the history of our nation and how best to celebrate our heritage. Now in his first book, In the Shadow of Statues, A White Southerner Confronts History, Landrieu discusses the path he took to remove the Confederate statues and traces his personal relationship to this history and tackling the broader history of slavery, race, and institutional inequality in America. Here's the opening of that speech that caught a lot of people's attention almost a year ago. Here's New Orleans Mayor Mitch Landrieu.
Thank you all for coming today. The soul of our beloved city is rooted in a history that has evolved over thousands of years, rooted in a diverse people who've been here together every step of the way, through good and through bad. It is a history, our history, that holds in its heart the stories of Native Americans, the Choctaw, the Homa, the Chittimacha, Hernando de Soto, Robert Cavalier, Sir de La Salle, the Acadians, the Eslenos, the enslaved people of Senegambia, free people of color, the Haitians, the Germans, both empires of France and Spain, the Italian, the Irish, the Cubans, the South and Central Americans, the Vietnamese, and so many more. You see, New Orleans is truly a city of many nations, a melting pot, a bubbling cauldron of many cultures. There is no other place quite like it in the world that so eloquently exemplifies the uniquely American motto, E pluribus unum, out of many, we are one. But there are also other truths about our city that we must confront. New Orleans was one of America's largest slave markets. a port where hundreds of thousands of souls were bought, sold, and shipped up the Mississippi River to lives of forced labor, of misery, of rape, and of torture. America was a place where nearly 4,000 of our fellow American citizens were lynched, 540 in Louisiana alone, where our courts enshrined separate but equal, where freedom riders were beaten to a bloody pulp. So when people say to me that the monuments in question are history, well, what I just described to you is our history as well. And it is a searing truth. And it immediately begs the question why there are no slave ship monuments, no prominent markers on public land to remember the lynchings or the slave blocks, nothing to remember this long chapter of our lives of pain, of sacrifice, of shame, all of it happening on the soil of New Orleans. So for those self-appointed defenders of history and the monuments, they are eerily silent on what amounts to historical malfeasance, a lie by omission. There is a difference, you see, between remembrance of history and the reverence of it. For America, New Orleans, it has been a long and winding road, marked by tragedy and triumph, but we cannot be afraid of the truth. As President George W. Bush said at the dedication ceremony for the National Museum of African American History and Culture, and I quote, "A great nation does not hide its history. It faces its flaws and it corrects them." So today I want to speak about why we chose to remove these four monuments to the lost cause of the Confederacy, but also how and why this process can move us towards healing and understanding each other.
Well, that was the opening of the speech that caught a lot of attention by New Orleans Mayor Mitch Landrieu back in May of last year, as he was discussing why the city of New Orleans took down four Confederate monuments that had been installed by supporters of, quote, the cult of the lost cause. We're going to talk with Mitch Landrieu, the mayor of New Orleans, right now. He's written a new book called In the Shadow of Statues, A White Southerner Confronts History. And here's the interview I did earlier today. Mayor Landrieu, welcome to WMNF. Great to have you here.
It's great to be with you. Thank you so much.
When did New Orleans decide to take down the statues of the Confederates?
Well, as everybody remembers, Katrina really hurt the city very badly. And following that, we had a number of other natural disasters and man-made disasters, including the recession and the BP oil spill. And we were in a position of having to really rebuild the entire city. So we rebuilt all of our schools. We're building a new airport. We're building a new riverfront. And in that context, we began thinking about our 300th anniversary, which, by the way, is in about a month. And so as we started looking around the city, we started thinking about the city we wanted to become. And those monuments were really, you know, right in the middle of everything. And Wynton Marsalis, who's a buddy of mine, one of the great jazz musicians of all time, said you should think about taking those statues down because they don't reflect who the city ever was. They really are somewhat of a historical lie. So we began to have a community discussion about that and went through a number of different public hearings. And the people, the people's representatives decided to take them down at my urging and the urging of a lot of other people who have been trying to do this for a very long time. And that's when we began the process.
Now, you grew up in New Orleans. Your dad was a mayor. What did you think of those statues growing up?
Well, that's the point. I didn't think much about them at all. I walked by them all the time and didn't really understand the impact that it had on our fellow citizens. Now, the city of New Orleans is 60% African-American, and one of the things Wynton asked me, you know, when I said, he said, you should take those down. I said, why? He goes, well, have you ever thought about them from our perspective? Who put them up? Why are they there? What message do they send? And it turns out that, you know, well after the Civil War ended, they were put up by people that were sympathetic to the Confederacy, that wanted to send a message that the Confederacy was actually a noble cause, and that the people who supported the Confederacy, not all Southerners and not all whites, but you know, that they were still in charge. And African Americans, many of them, fled the South, and we have become worse for it because of that. And so as the city of New Orleans thinks about, you know, the message that she wants to send the rest of the world, we want to remind people that we were here before the country was here. Our birthday is in 1718, and that we've always been a multicultural society, and that we believe diversity is a strength, not a weakness.
Now, you say that these statues are part of an effort to hide the truth, and you alluded to that a moment ago, but could you explain that a little further?
I didn't allude to it. I speak to it very directly in the book. There was a purposeful effort well after the Civil War ended to erect Confederate monuments across the country, most prominently in the South. There are about 3,000 of them. And they were designed by the same group of people purposefully to basically say, well, actually, the Confederacy was a noble cause, that it was really fought over economics, not over slavery, and to send a pretty clear message, just like Jim Crow laws and other laws to African-Americans, that even though the United States won that war and that freedom was supposed to be the order of the day, that they still needed to understand that they were less than the rest of us. And it was a purposeful attempt to really kind of promote the notion of white supremacy. That's, of course, if you live in the United States, America is inconsistent with the ideals of this country, which is that we ought to be judging people based on the behavior, not their race, their creed, their color, their nation of origin, and their sexual orientation. And so those monuments also are in places of prominence. They're not stuck off on the side in the city of New Orleans. They occupy the most prominent spaces, and they really don't reflect in New Orleans the history of who we are or what the ethos of our city is or ever was.
We're talking with the mayor of New Orleans, Mitch Landrieu, about his new book, In the Shadow of Statues, A White Southerner Confronts History, and you're listening to WMNF in Tampa. Was there pushback when the city decided to take down the statues?
Yes, there was a lot of pushback, you know, and it came in a lot of different forms. I had a pretty good feeling inside the city that the majority of the people in New Orleans who owned the property were in favor of taking them down, although not all of us were. People that did not live in the city, who felt like they had some sense of ownership in the city, you know, had an opinion about it. And then, of course, people from across the country, you know, felt as though now this was risen to the level of a national issue, and they had opinions. It was a very heated time. We had a lot of public hearings. There were a lot of court cases about it. But eventually, through the democratic process, you know, we arrived at what the answer was going to be, which is that we want to take them down and that we had the right to do it. But I would say that it was a very emotional issue. You know, we don't really talk about race very well in this country. We don't do it in a very constructive way. And as I've said too many times, this book really is not a condemnation. It's not a judgment. It's an invitation for people to rethink where they were based on new information that they may not have understood. My mother even said to me, you know, son, I read your book. They didn't teach us that in school. They taught us a different history. But now that they understand it and know it, it helps us get to a better place.
When you gave your famous speech last May, and we played a little bit at the top of this show, you talked about how extensive and how inclusive New Orleans history was, and that, you know, these statues really celebrate 5 years of Southern history, excluding, as you pointed to, the 300-year history of New Orleans, and the role that so many ethnic groups played in the rise of your city.
Well, you know, I make a couple of points. The opposition makes it a point of saying that we're destroying history. No, I actually am telling the real history. What they really did was took 4 years of hundreds of years of living and consolidated and said, no, we're going to occupy all of the land based on a misinterpretation of what happened during a very small part of our history. As I have reminded people, we're about to celebrate our 300th anniversary and want to welcome everybody to the city to help us celebrate our birthday. But we were founded in 1718. And, of course, if people think about that, that's before the United States became the United States of America. We are a unique city in the sense that we had the countries of Spain and France fly their flags over us, which meant that, you know, there were people from those countries that were here, people from Senegal and Gambia. This is the place where jazz music was created. And jazz, of course, as you know, is the assimilation of a number of different art forms from a number of different countries. Our food is unique. And so we represent, in kind of a really interesting way, that uniquely American aspiration of out of many, we are one. We actually live that every day. And so these Confederate monuments were actually an affront to that very idea, and in my opinion, an historical lie. Because if you tell somebody an itty-bitty piece of the story, and you don't tell them the whole story, of course they're not getting the accurate picture. And so these things have to be reflected appropriately. They should be in places of remembrance, which is different from places of reverence. And it's a very different thing. We can do both of those things in the country and make sure that we invite everybody into the conversation.
You mentioned your mom a moment ago. What was she surprised about learning? What was one of the things she was surprised about learning in the book?
Well, she, again, the whole history of the Lost Cause and how these monuments were put up, you know, they never learned that. It's like somebody saying Columbus discovered America. Well, he didn't really. that's what we learned when we were kids.
Yeah.
In the state of Louisiana, for example, 1,000 years before the city of New Orleans was discovered, they had fairly sophisticated Native Americans here before we got here. People never really understood that until the story. The more information we have and the more we recognize, you know, their contribution, the better we are for it. And so when you think about, you know, the gift that we get from realizing what different cultures contributed and how we got where we are is the important story. Not trying to take one group of people, isolating them, giving them prominence, and acting like nothing else ever happened. And, of course, more important to this on the issue of race is this concept of slavery as some historical thing that happened that didn't really have any impact. There were 5 million people that were in slavery. We sold more people into slavery in the southern, in New Orleans, really, than anywhere else in, of course, the South. Now, let me hasten to say that there is discrimination and racism all over America. And as a Southerner, I get my back up a little bit when people from the North say it only happened down here. It didn't. It's happening all over the place. And it's one of these things that we have to address in this country, you know, in an effort to move forward. Now, we've made a lot of progress. There's no question about that. But we have a long way to go. And this is just another very small step in that effort, you know, to talk about how we reconcile as a country, and out of many, we become one.
We're talking with Mitch Landrieu. The book is In the Shadow of Statues, A White Southerner Confronts History. I think for the folks that support the Confederate monuments, they feel like they're losing something, and it's a zero-sum game. That is that, you know, they lose something, and the folks that are against the statues win something, and they're getting nothing out of it. What do you say to those folks who say they feel like they've lost?
Well, of course, that's a misunderstanding of human nature. And of course, that's the point. We don't lose when we come together. We only lose when we separate ourselves based on race. And one of the things I talk about in the book is how much we lost when 5 million people left the South and took their intellect and their capital and went to New York and Detroit and other places. I speak often about how New Orleans in 1960 was bigger than Atlanta and bigger than Houston, but now is smaller than both of them. Much of that is because some people felt unwelcome and excluded. So I would say to the people, who seem to be locked into this false remembrance of the past, let it go. We're better together. It really, diversity is a strength. It's not a weakness, and we're all going to benefit. It's not a zero-sum game. And that's what people in America seem to be, unfortunately, so afraid of. And I think that some of this is just a little bit of fear that in 2040, you know, the complexion of America is going to change. Well, it's been changing since the day that we were born. You know, there were times when, you know, we were really racist and had issues of bigotry towards Italians and then the Irish. America constantly recreates itself because America is not about the color of people's skin. That's not what we're about. We're not about nation of origin. We're not about all those things. We're about behavior. And we win based on merit. And we have to accept everybody based on that. We cannot be separated by these other false things that separate us. So I would say to them, don't worry. The book really is not a condemnation. It's an invitation to people to think differently, to open up their minds. And it's an offer to come back together. And some people have taken that offer, and, you know, some people haven't. But I think that we have to continue to march in that direction.
And yesterday in Baton Rouge, the police officers involved in the killing of a black man were the local authorities decided not to pursue charges against the police officers. What do you say to the black community that feels like they're not being heard?
Well, I think that there is a lot of truth there. You know, of course, across America, we have had very difficult issues in the last 10 years with police-involved shootings. Now, the city of New Orleans, which is down the street from Baton Rouge, has been under federal consent decree for the past 8 years, and we have been working very hard on this issue. When there is a police-involved shooting here, what happens immediately is that the scene gets cordoned off. We actually have an investigative team that have independent police monitors and the FBI in it. The incident gets vetted appropriately and thoughtfully. All of our police officers now have body cameras, and police officers are taught now not to shoot first, but to shoot last. And so what the African-American community has rightly said over time is that, you know, that there may be justification for police officers, but we never know that because they're not investigated appropriately and properly. And, of course, police departments in the country are struggling with this because most police officers are good folks, but obviously you're seeing from videotapes that there's some officers that do the wrong thing in the wrong circumstance. And I think that in Baton Rouge, the African-American community doesn't feel like this particular incident was investigated appropriately. It wasn't investigated by the local authorities. It was investigated by the state attorney general and the Department of Justice, which they don't have a lot of trust in at the moment. And so now this matter is going to go to the local authorities. It'll go to the mayor, and it'll go to the police chief for their review and judgment.
One last question, that is, can you envision a political movement? We've seen the rise of these kind of neo-Nazi and hate groups and KKK. Can you envision a political movement involving people coming together across racial, across ethnic lines to make a better country?
Yes, I can. I actually can. We've seen it a number of different times, but you see both, right? You've seen in the last 2 years the rise of the white supremacist movement who felt like it's a comfortable time to come out of the shadows. I would push back on that very forcefully. I don't think that we could give that any quarter in the United States of America. And I have, because of what I saw after Katrina, which was a huge outpouring of love and support of people that acted differently and were different towards each other, that were different from them. I have great hope that the country can come together, but it will not be easy. It's emotional. It's sensitive. It's hard for us to talk about. And in the book, I try to explain what it is that we went through in New Orleans so people can helpfully learn from it. And yes, I have a lot of hope and optimism about the future, but it's not an easy path to walk. But it is one that we would have to choose to walk through.
Mitch Landrieu, thanks a lot for coming on WMNF.
Sure. Thanks for having me. Have a great day.
That was Mitch Landrieu, the mayor of New Orleans, speaking to WMNF earlier today. He's written a new book called In the Shadow of Statues, A White Southerner Confronts History. Mitch Landrieu is the current mayor of New Orleans. He's completing his second four-year term. He's a Democrat. He served as lieutenant governor of Louisiana from 2004 to 2010, and he's currently the president of the U.S. Conference of Mayors. So if you want to comment about what you've heard here for the last few minutes, you can email us in the studio, our address, dj@wmnf.org. And you can also call us up at 813-239-9663. I want to read a few other stories that I think that we should consider talking about today. The state of Florida is being ordered by a federal judge to come up with a new way of deciding how and when former prisoners can get their voting rights restored. Yesterday, a federal judge in Tallahassee blocked the state's current system of forcing ex-felons to wait at least 5 years before they can get the right to vote. The judge gave Governor Rick Scott and state officials until April 26th to come up with a new process. Florida's Constitution bars felons from being able to vote after leaving prison automatically. The state's clemency process leaves it up to the governor and three elected cabinet members to decide whether or not to restore voting rights. Ex-felons must petition individually, a process that takes years. So that's a big story out there on the front page of the local newspaper today, the Tampa Bay Times. And another story broke this morning, an attorney for an adult film star claiming a sexual encounter with President Trump is seeking to depose the president and his attorney. The attorney, Michael Avenatti, filed the motion in federal court in California. In the documents today, he seeks to depose Trump and Trump attorney Michael Cohen about a $130,000 payment made to Stormy Daniels just days before the 2016 presidential election. Avenatti wants to question each, Cohen and Trump, for no more than 2 hours. In the filing, he says the depositions are needed to establish if Trump knew about the payment and if he consented to it. Cohen has said he paid the $130,000 out of his own pocket while asserting that Trump never had sex with the porn actress. A hearing on this motion is set for next month. And President Trump says the Second Amendment will not be repealed. The president is making a pledge a day after retired Supreme Court Justice John Paul Stevens expressed a different view. Stevens wrote in a New York Times op-ed that repealing the Second Amendment would help Congress enact gun control measures. Trump tweeted early this morning, "The Second Amendment will never be repealed, as much as Democrats would like to see this happen." And despite the words yesterday of former Supreme Court Justice Stevens, "No way," the president tweeted. "We need more Republicans in 2018 and must always hold on to the Supreme Court." That was the president's tweet this morning. The Supreme Court ruled in 2008 that the amendment lets people own guns for self-defense, the first time that the court ruled that way. And so that's in fact, the Tampa Bay Times reprinted the op-ed by Justice John Paul Stevens. And I'll just read from some of it. I want to get your take on this. The headline in the Tampa Bay Times today on page 7A is "The Case for Repealing the Second Amendment." And I'll read a little bit of this. "Concerned that a national standing army might pose a threat to the security of the separate states led to the adoption of that Second Amendment, which provides that a well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed." Stevens writes, "Today, that concern is a relic of the 18th century. He goes on to write, "For over 200 years after the adoption of the Second Amendment, it was uniformly understood as not placing any limit on either federal or state authority to enact gun control legislation." He writes that in 1939, the Supreme Court unanimously held that Congress could prohibit the possession of a sawed-off shotgun because that weapon had no reasonable relation to the preservation or efficiency of a well-regulated militia. And Stevens goes on to say that during the years when Warren Burger was our Chief Justice from 1969 to 1986, no judge, federal or state, as far as I am aware, expressed any doubt as to the limited coverage of the Second Amendment. When organizations like the National Rifle Association disagreed with that position and began their campaign claiming that federal regulation of firearms curtailed Second Amendment rights, Chief Justice Burger publicly characterized the NRA as perpetrating one of the greatest pieces of fraud, I repeat the word fraud, on the American public by special interest groups that I've ever seen in my lifetime. Let's listen in on what Warren Burger, then the Chief Justice of the U.S., said about the Second Amendment and whether or not it was as described by the NRA. This is what he said on PBS in 1991.
"With a safety plan,
which Chief required Justice me not of the U.S. to Supreme leave Court from 1969 to 1986. Charlene Hunter Gault spoke to him last week.
If I were writing the Bill of Rights now, there wouldn't be any such thing as the Second Amendment.
Which says?
That a well-regulated militia being necessary for the defense of the state, the people's rights to bear arms. This has been the subject of one of the greatest pieces of fraud. I repeat the word fraud on the American public by special interest groups that I have ever seen in my lifetime." Now just look at those words. There are only three lines to that amendment. A well-regulated militia. If the militia, which was going to be the state army, was going to be well-regulated, why shouldn't 16 and 17 and 18 or any other age persons be regulated in the use of arms the way an automobile is regulated?
The news of the...
All right, so that was former Chief Justice Warren Burger, who was a Republican Supreme Court nominee, speaking about the history of the Second Amendment there on PBS in 1991, saying that the description of that the NRA uses, that there should be no regulation of firearms, he says, one of the greatest pieces of fraud on the American public by a special interest group that I've ever seen in my lifetime. 813-239-9663. So former Justice John Paul Stevens, his op-ed concludes by saying that overturning the Heller decision via constitutional amendment to get rid of the Second Amendment would be simple and would do more to weaken the NRA's ability to stymie legislative debate and block constructive gun control legislation than any other available option. That simple but dramatic action would move Saturday's marchers closer to their objective than any other possible reform. It would eliminate the only legal rule that protects sellers of firearms in the U.S., unlike every other market in the world, and it would make our school children safer than they have been since 2008 and honor the many, indeed far too many, victims of recent gun violence. So, and underneath that op-ed in today's Tampa Bay Times, there's a writer, Christopher Ingram, who points out that only about 1 in 5 Americans support repealing the Second Amendment. So we could talk about John Paul Stevens' op-ed in today's Tampa Bay Times and yesterday's New York Times. What do you think? Our phone number, 813-239-9663. And our email address is dj@wmnf.org. And do you think, what would be your way to reduce gun violence? Some people think that we should arm more people. What do you think? 813-239-9663, email address dj@wmnf.org. Jeff Haynes is our phone producer today. And we're going to go to Daryl in Tampa. Hey, Daryl, you're on MNF. What would you like to say?
How you doing?
I'm good.
Well, first, I believe his name is Mitch Landrieu. I've heard of him before. I would give him serious consideration, and I would vote for the man. I'm a Democrat. I like what he has to say. I would vote for him. On the second thing about the repealing of the Second Amendment, I think that's the most asinine, ridiculous thing that I've ever heard. Talk about throwing a dead cat on the table. There you go. I don't have a problem with the Second Amendment. What I do have a big, big problem with is that the definition, people defining what the Second Amendment means. We have a large standing army. We have also a Marine Corps. We also have a large standing Navy. And they didn't imagine that back then, but we have a large standing Air Force. We have weekend warriors. We have National Guardsmen. That's not the problem. The problem is people misinterpreting the Second Amendment such that they think that they should have weapons of war like AR-14s and M-16s, and if they could get away with it, Gatling guns. And ask them why is it not possible for you to purchase a Tommy gun? Think about the gangsters and stuff like that. So, no, I don't have any problems like that. I just have the problems with the interpreting of it.
All right, Daryl, thanks a lot. You know, we interviewed the Republican Party chair in Hillsborough County, and they had a gun shooting event last weekend. In the flyer that they were inviting people to come to the shootout event in Brandon, they said, leave your bazookas at home. And I don't think it was entirely in jest. I think there are some people that think that there should be no limits on the arms that individual citizens can have.
You mean I couldn't bring my hand grenade?
Yeah. I think they suggested that was on the list, too. They said leave those at home, too. All right, Daryl, thanks a lot. 813-239-9663. Let's go to Sean, who's in Tampa. Hey, Sean, you're on. What would you like to comment about?
Yes, good morning. Thank you for taking my call. So I just want to say, you know, I'm an avid gun owner. I've been in the military for a very long time, over 16 years. You know, I took an oath to uphold the Constitution. Now, you know, even if I didn't own a gun, you know, the Constitution was written by our founding fathers, and it's a standing document. You know, if you eliminate one amendment, you know, who knows what's next? And I'm not even going to get out of firearms debate, but just think about that, though. I mean, if they are able to remove one amendment, you know, a few hundred years down the road, or, you know, 50 years down the road, what could be potentially next?
Well, could it be that there may be a point at which amendments don't really address the needs of the country? Could you ever conceive of that, where an amendment doesn't really fit the needs of the country?
You know, so the foundation of the country I don't like labeling. I really don't. I don't like anybody calling me a progressive, a centralist, or whatever. I really don't. But, you know, I guess you would call me a libertarian. I mean, like, I think laws are there for a reason. I think the foundation of our Constitution and our country should stay the way it is.
Now, yeah. Well, I, you know, and my guess is...
Yes,
my, my, my,
no,
well,
no, let,
Let me get in here for just a second, Sean. You know, my guess is that I don't think that there's an appetite to repeal the Second Amendment, but we still have this problem of what to do about gun violence, and there doesn't seem to be any major movement in Tallahassee or in Congress. So I think that's the frustration that a lot of people are feeling, that we're still having students shot in schools, and we're still having people shot on the streets who are innocent, that we're not, those of us that don't own guns aren't safe from being shot. And I think people are demanding more safety. So what would you suggest?
One, far and foremost, and this honestly from somebody that's a federal employee that's been in the military for a long time, I'm telling you, there's no reason why the Sheriff's Department and the FBI dropped the ball the way they did. That's where the failure on all this is. Now, I'm not going to say that this kid should have never had a firearm, but that's a parental failure as well.
Well, and there were...
Everybody can blame everything on the gun, but nobody is talking about the fact that this kid...
Okay, so, all right, so Sean, you're right. I mean, I think the FBI got tips. The local sheriff's department got tips. And Health and Human, there were social service people employed by the state of Florida who got word that this kid was dangerous. So should everybody in those organizations be fired, including the top leaders of those organizations?
Fired, no, reprimanded, yes. Reprimanded.
Okay, but how would that prevent a future shooting?
One, maybe not a future shooting, but it'll make an example, and it'll tell the other agencies that they have to take their job seriously.
Okay, all right. Well, let's see if other people agree. Sean, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
All right, so you heard Sean's idea for stopping gun violence. What do you think? You think that's going to work? 813-239-9663. I think it's interesting, too, that, you know, there's been a lot of pushback against John Paul Stevens, the former Supreme Court justice, and his call to repeal the Second Amendment. And there's been a lot of pushback against the young people who organized that massive rally in Washington, D.C., and rallies across the country. There's been a lot of pushback and kind of hate speech against those folks. And I want to just kind of suggest that we address that, too. And again, our phone number, 813-239-9663. You can also email into the studio here, dj@wmnf.org. Let's go to Cynthia, who's in Bradenton. Hey, Cynthia, you're on. What would you like to say?
Thank you. I don't think the Founding Fathers imagined automatic rifles. And I think that any money and effort that would be spent on trying to repeal the Second Amendment would be much better spent getting everyone 18 and older to register to vote and to call out every single politician who gets NRA money. There is no reason a U.S. citizen needs an automatic weapon. No reason. We have got to get those off our streets. That's my opinion. That's where the money and the effort should go.
All right, Cynthia, thanks a lot. Weapons of war, get them off the streets.
Exactly.
Yeah. Okay. All right, Cynthia, great to hear from you. And let's go to Sid, who's in Tampa. Hi, Sid, you're on. What would you like to say?
Hi, Rob. Good point about Justice Stevens' comment. I think he's certainly entitled his legal opinion. I think it's politically counterproductive. I don't think there are any leading Democrats right now that are calling for a repeal of the Second Amendment. And that, like Trump tweeted, his comment, Stevens' comment, is going to be used as a polarizing type thing. Interestingly, that 2008 Heller decision, although it validated the Second Amendment, it did say that careful regulation of guns is certainly warranted. I think even Scalia wrote something that said that regulation of guns is warranted, even within the context of the Second Amendment. And I think that argument, I think it will be more effective and more plausible to the American people and has more chance of getting implemented rather than a repeal of the Second Amendment. Just real quick, I do want to say, I've read the Second Amendment, and I don't think it necessarily guarantees weapons to individuals, but be that as it may, I think calling for repeal, I think, would be politically counterproductive and get the wrong people elected.
All right, Sid, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Thanks. Okay, so we're getting a lot of comments about John Paul Stevens' op-ed in the New York Times and the Tampa Bay Times today. Our phone number, 813-239-9663. Gina says nobody's answering our phones. I think what happens is that we've got one dead line. And so if you're unlucky enough to call up when the deadline is next in the queue, I think that's what happens. Gina, don't give up on us. You might hang up and try calling back. 813-239-9663. Tony writes this. Ex-felons voting in Florida, the judicial decision yesterday. Tony writes, this could have a huge political impact on this evenly divided state. It's estimated that over a million cannot vote, who in most other states would be eligible after serving their time. Florida's Republicans hold on to absolute power by depressing the total vote. This, as well as gerrymandering, is another way they do it. And we the people do it to ourselves when such a low number usually turns out for midterm elections. That's Tony's email. Tony, thank you for your email. Frank writes this. Why don't we read and follow the entire Second Amendment and regulate the militia? It's right there. Second Amendment, as I mentioned before, says a well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. So, you know, some people like to choose just two or three lines from that amendment, and some people want to honor the whole amendment. What do you think? 813-239-9663. And what do you think about these attempts by some to denigrate the work of the high school students from Parkland who organized the rally over the weekend? What do you think? 813-239-9663. You're listening to Radioactivity on WMNF in Tampa. I'm Rob Lurie. Let's go to Kaylee in Zephyr Hills. Hi, Kaylee. You're on MNF. Thanks for calling
Rob.
In.
Hi. How are you this morning?
I'm great. How are you?
Good. You just raised precisely the question that I was calling about, denigrating these young people who are so brave and have channeled their grief into this activity. I have been so frustrated. I'm very active in a lot of political groups online and Facebook, and I cannot believe the divisiveness in this country. You know, I'm ready to hit 60 this year, and I've not in my life seen this country so divided. And I've got to tell you, the people who are on the side of guns, when you try to argue with them, they've got nothing. All they've got is, you know, these people are idiots. These people, I've been called a libtard and a snowflake, which I think is funny now. At first, I was
don't you think when people call names, don't you think that they've lost? You know, when they don't have a thoughtful,
absolutely. That's why I say they've got nothing.
Right.
They don't. They're basing their opinions. Well, they're basing their beliefs about things strictly on their opinions. And I've been doing a great, you know, a lot of research. I listen to your show every day when I'm commuting to work. It falls at the perfect time. And, you know, I yesterday went through and I said, okay, these people in groups that I'm in that have to make fun of people who are trying to, in some small way, change the world. And in the case of these Parkland survivors, in a big way. I mean, look at what they did. It's just unbelievable. And to denigrate them, you know, when they're surviving this trauma, it's just ridiculous.
I was watching some video from one of President Trump's favorite networks, InfoWars. And they were comparing the young people from Parkland who organized the rally on Saturday to Nazis. And I thought, that is so out of bounds. I mean, the InfoWars people are already out there. I'm going to, in just a second, I'm going to play a clip from InfoWars that shows how wrong they can be about something. But the president watches these folks. You know, the president's supporters are on that network. It's a far right wing conspiracy theory fueled network that's really out to try to undermine, I think, the hard work that these teens have done from Parkland.
Right. Well, you know, I've been observing the people who just name call. And that's who our president is. He said that he was a great college student and he's a genius. And I'm sorry, but he lies about everything. And I think he's really deluding himself if he thinks that he's intelligent. If he is, he's very lazy because he does the same thing. He name calls. He doesn't have anything to support his opinions. He just throws this name and says how wonderful he is, which we all know, but I had to vent. I'm just...
All right. Well, Kaylee, thanks.
So
thanks for
frustrated with him. Thank you for your show.
All right.
You know, you've had some people on lately that I've really learned a lot from listening to them, so I appreciate it.
Well, thanks, Kaylee. Thanks.
All right.
Thanks for saying that. Thanks for your kind words.
You
know, one of the president's favorite people is Alex Jones from InfoWars. If you were watching InfoWars just a few weeks ago, you would know this, that North Korea is about to launch an attack. Now, let's listen in on this is what Alex Jones is telling his people, trying to rile them up. And listen to what he says, and listen to how wrong he is, because the attack is supposed to begin right now. Here's from just a few weeks ago, Alex Jones on InfoWars predicting an attack by North Korea right about now against Japan.
North Korean chatter and preparations, both from human intelligence and signals, states that North Korea is at this time planning a preemptive strike against Japan, Tokyo, with ICBMs starting in the last 2 days of March going into April 2nd. So anywhere within that 4 or 5 day period. And that everyone, especially families of armed service members, should not be traveling and should not be leaving the United States during that period. And because they don't want to officially put that announcement out, they want that announcement put out to this audience because you are seen as the most awake, patriotic Americans.
So, you know, poor Alex Jones, he looks like he's going to have a heart attack as he announces this. He's saying that North Korea is going to launch an attack right now. And he made this prediction a few weeks ago. And he's trying to rile up his people just like he attacks the teenagers from Parkland as if they're doing something that's out of bounds. They're practicing the great American tradition of peacefully protesting. We have a long tradition of doing that. And if you went to one of the demonstrations or protests over the weekend, you know what a great group of people that was. This was not an angry crowd. This was, maybe they were angry at gun violence, but it was families, it was business people, it was activists, it was students, it was young people, it was children, it was moms and dads. It was incredible. And for Alex Jones to start attacking the Parkland students or putting out this paranoia about North Korea, it doesn't do us a service. Our phone number is 813-239-9663. Email address dj@wmnf.org. Let's go to Mary in Gulfport. Hi, Mary. You're on. What would you like to say?
Hi.
Hi.
Hi. Yeah, I think it's disgusting what they're doing to the kids. And I was at the protest, so there was no violence, nothing. It just horrible. But I was thinking, too, I've been thinking along these lines, is some the money that goes into the NRA that they buy our politicians with, if we overthrow Citizens United, or they change that in some way, that decision, all this money wouldn't pour into all these folks. So.
And we're going to talk about Citizens United this Friday. I've got one of the national experts on trying to undo Citizens United. He's going to be on this show Friday at 11:20.
Oh, excellent. Because I think a lot of it is just paid politicians. The money is greater. And if that money's taken away, the NRA can't buy politicians.
Yeah, I think that's right. And the arms manufacturers are, you know, every time Alex Jones tries to scare people about guns, the arms manufacturers make money because scared people go out and buy guns. Yeah.
Exactly. I mean, it's total trash, and he's total trash. So I don't know how people believe him.
All right, Mary, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
All right.
Bye-bye.
We'll get through this. So let's go to Karen, who's in Tampa. Hi, Karen, you're on. What would you like to say?
Hey, Rob. Well, I think you actually may have already mentioned what I was going to say, which my question was going to be like, how have we let them go on for so long, you know, just focusing on that one part of it about, you know, not about their rights and forgetting about the well-regulated part. I mean, it says well-regulated, so why aren't we regulating, you know? And I think every time somebody tries to start yelling about their right to bear arms, we should just keep repeating, well-regulated.
Well, huh? You know, the NRA, which built a fabulous headquarters in Washington, D.C., says it's based on the Second Amendment, that its organization is based on the Second Amendment. But when they inscribed the Second Amendment onto the headquarters of the NRA in Washington, D.C., they did not include the whole amendment, and they left off well-regulated.
Well, of course, because, you know, they don't like that part. So it's just, the whole thing is just disgusting. I don't think repealing that amendment wouldn't work. What we really need is an amendment that says that, you know, you can't give vast amounts, that corporations are not people and do not have the right to be treated as people, and, you know, cannot give huge amounts of money to politicians. But, you know, that's a whole other issue. And I'm
going to talk about it. I'll talk about it on Friday. Karen, thanks a lot.
Thanks. Can I say one more quick thing?
Sure.
I think the kids are so cool, and I'm so impressed by how, I mean, it took them like 2 days to put together, you know, this massive movement. And they're so, like, media savvy and so cool being on camera. You know, it's like a different world, and they're all so good at all that stuff. And I'm really impressed. It gives me, like, a slight amount of hope that I haven't had in a really long time. So.
All right. Karen, thanks a lot. Great to hear from you. Gina writes this, I'm very much in favor of gun control. I think the NRA needs to be neutered, but I think repealing the Second Amendment is a horrible idea. First, there are so many things this country can do before taking such a drastic route. First, a ban on assault weapons, strengthen and strictly enforce background checks, put contribution limits on the NRA for starters. If you open up repeal, who's to say there won't be efforts to tamper with that pesky First Amendment, writes Gina. And James writes this, what would Sean say about Paddock? There was no police report. He was 60 years old. Are you going to blame his parents? You can't just reason or shame these Second Amendment people. That's James talking about the Las Vegas shooter. Chip in Tampa says, why doesn't the discussion about mass shootings begin with the banning of assault weapons and high-capacity magazines? Ask all the pro-gun callers to defend the legality of them. Think you'll find that there is no reasonable, rational defense, writes Chip. Well, you're listening to WMNF in Tampa. We're going to go back to the phones, and let's go to Martha, who's in Winter Haven. Hi, Martha, you're on. What would you like to say?
Hi. I have, first of all, I would like to say that I agree with Justice Stevens. There was an old folk song, I can't remember who it was. It was a woman that sang it many years ago. And the chorus was, if it were up to me, I'd take away all the guns. I happen to agree with that. I realize that that's not realistic. The thing that frustrates me so deeply is that the NRA continues to reframe the national argument, the national discussion, onto really extremist, black and white terms that the majority of Americans don't really, you know, we don't agree with that, and it's not what we're looking for. Most reasonable Americans want, you know, universal background checks. We want the gun show exception to go away. We want closer control of internet sales. We want, you know, domestic violence and terror. People that have been arrested for those things to be banned from owning guns. These are reasonable moves that most Americans agree with. But when the NRA sees that, they reframe the argument immediately to they're coming after your guns. They're trying to take away your constitutional rights. And that isn't what the majority of us want at all.
Well, I think you're exactly right, Martha. I agree with you. Thanks a lot. I think it's your comments are brilliant. Thank you.
Well, thank you.
Okay.
Appreciate it.
All right. Bye. And let's go to Rob in Lutz. You're listening to WMNF in Tampa. Hey, Rob, you're on. We got 30 seconds.
Yes, sir. Going back to Mayor Landrieu of New Orleans and the banning of the removal of the Confederate mementos, has anyone ever thought about changing the state flag of Florida with the Red Cross arms over the white field?
Well, that's been brought up several times. You might want to call your state senator and state representative to tell them what you think.
Yes, I just thought maybe some other callers might know that.
Yeah. All right, Rob, thanks a lot. All right, great to hear from you. If you want to comment about today's show, please call us up at 813-238-8001. Record your comment on extension 115, and I'll play those comments back tomorrow morning at 11 o'clock. Martha called in, and she said that old folk song, that's by Cheryl Wheeler, maybe we should play that sometime. Stay tuned for the Midpoint program with NOLA. This is WMNF in Tampa.